Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts Pocket, episode 6. I'm Ray Barnholtz, your steed, your captain for this. With me, as always, Bob Mackey.
Hello.
And Jeremy Parrish.
Wait, you're a steed, so do we have to ride you around?
I'm cutting you out.
Damn it. Not of the will.
He's the god now.
And our special guest from last episode, Matt Leone.
Hello.
Hi, and thanks for sticking around. So this pocket episode, much like my last one, will be about accessories. And last time I covered NES accessories. And this time you may think I would cover Super NES accessories. But no, I'm going to do a 180. I'm going to flip your script. I'm going to totally rock your world by covering Sega Genesis accessories.
People are still going to say we talk about Nintendo too much.
Yeah. Hey, I'm very... Folks, let's just wait and see.
Give us a chance.
We're getting the softballs out of the way first.
I'm going to say, this may not be the most positive one, but only because we're talking about accessories and not games or anything. So keep that in mind. So to preface things, I could have covered the Master System, but pretty much everything about the Master System came from Sega themselves, and there were not that many accessories. There was like the arcade stick and the 3D glasses.
And the light phaser.
Yep. And in Japan, the FM sound unit. But that's pretty much it. So in the rise of like the 16-bit days with the Genesis, many more companies came in and saw an opportunity to cash in by creating off-market accessories, aftermarket. And Sega still made quite a few themselves, though. And I think one of the earliest ones that I'll start with is the power base converter, which is linked to the Master System, quite literally. It is the converter box that you plug into the top of the Genesis, and then you plug in your Master System cartridges or cards right into them. And it's backwards compatibility for a small fee.
Do we know what that fee was?
It's probably like
the price of a game or something, or is it much more?
I'd imagine it'd be more in the game price range.
I think it was $99.
Wow.
Okay.
Or thereabouts. But basically that was Sega doing what Nintendo don't, because, you know, Nintendo very famously had originally said, oh, we're going to put backward compatibility into the Super Famicom so you can play Famicom games. Mm. Same with the Super NES. You can play NES games. And then Nintendo doesn't, I don't know, their business model is, you know, keep it lean, keep it minimal, cut down extra costs. And eventually they decided, why do we want people to be able to continue using their old libraries when we could cut costs on the hardware and make them buy entirely new games?
I think that was less obvious when you compare how you put in games in the NES compared to how you put in games with Super Nintendo. But in Japan, they were both top-loading, so it would be more logical jump.
Yeah, I mean, eventually they made a top-loading NES.
Right, but not until like 93 or something?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Something like that.
But yeah, I mean, the Super Famicom and Famicom had more similar cartridges.
Yeah.
And that was also the case for the Master System and the Genesis.
Right.
They had those low-profile, stubby cartridges.
Yeah. Not to harp on Nintendo too much right at the start, but...
Let's talk about Sega. We first need to talk about Nintendo.
You know, the prototypes of the Super Famicom, you know, did involve, like, what they called a Famicom adapter, which was also a redesigned Famicom.
It was just a separate slot.
I'm thinking of, like, photos from, like, an old press event where they had two different units, and the explanation behind them was a bit foggy. But yeah, so the power base converter lets you play all those Master System games, or at least most of them. I don't know if there were any incompatibilities, but
none that I've heard of. Yeah. It was a Master System chip.
Yeah,
And it was just basically like a pass through to use the Genesis's video out system to play like Master System hardware.
Yeah, makes sense. And of course, I don't know how many people really bought one, considering the percentage of Master System users in America, at least, compared to Nintendo. But they distributed it nonetheless, and yeah, it was what Nintendo didn't.
And there were some out there, because I did end up buying one used, and had it for a while for a Genesis I owned, and it was kind of neat.
I mean, if you were smart enough to think, you know, I can get this thing for, you know, probably cheaper than a Master System, then get some of the good Master System games also for cheap, then I have a little bit of an extra library.
Yeah, and you know,
if you cared enough about games,
I mean, right? And I mean, if you are someone who owns a 16-bit console and you really want to play ALF, how are you going to play an ALF game besides using a Master Base or Power Base converter?
Big shrug is my
exactly
my reaction.
You could play ALF, one of the many other ALF games.
But that's what I'm saying. There were none.
I know.
Maybe a browser game. I don't know.
Alf and Pog World.
That was a hack of Alex Kidd, right? In Brazil.
I wish. Why didn't they just take Alex Kidd, chop off one of those Sarahs from the E? I was thinking, yeah, well.
Wow.
Right?
Okay. Alf X, that's kind of the...
No, no. Okay, and the X.
That's the extreme 90s version of Alf.
No, okay. Good. That's still good.
After his life on the world of Melmac.
All right.
Gordon Shumway goes hardcore.
One thing I do want to say is that there were a few things you could plug into the Genesis cartridge slot, including the 32X. But it's that and the Sega CD, technically those were platforms. Those are separate platforms for extra games. And so I don't consider them accessories so much in terms of this discussion, at least. So
I consider 32X an accessory to a crime.
Yeah, that is true. That is
and
true.
And the death of Sega.
You can define it that way. Word of caution.
Yeah, well, no, Sega CD definitely was a viable platform on its own. There was a lot of good stuff for that system, even if it didn't all come to the U.S.
Just a note for listeners, we won't really be talking about those. But next I want to jump to Japan and talk about the Mega Modem, which was released pretty much like a couple years after the Mega Drive came out in Japan, and one of many different kinds of modems that were released for the Genesis.
Question for you, Ray. I was this ever advertised in the United States before it didn't come over here? Because I remember seeing it like on a poster or something, mm-hmm. or something like of that nature, mm-hmm. some kind of PR material.
Yeah, it was one of those, we intend to release this at some point, maybe, mm-hmm. who knows. But yeah, it did actually come out in Japan and was supported by Sega. It was basically not just the modem, but it was basically like a package of different network-related things. You had the cartridge interface and whatever else. And, of course, you could access an online service that provided you with game downloads. Not full game downloads, but original, like, smaller games offered by Sega, such as, like, little puzzle games, Sonic-based puzzle games, and Pyramid Magic, which was brought back on GameTap, I believe, in America, distributed that way. And the Phantasy Star Text Adventures... yeah, different like visual novels, that sort of thing. Very short form, small games distributed over the network. And of course, it is a precursor to the Sega Channel, which we can also talk about as well right now. Released, I believe, in 94 or 95 in America. Basically, a cable modem for the Genesis. You would hook it in there, and then, assuming you had the correct cable provider that Sega had a partnership with, Time Warner, I suppose, or TCI, you could get access to this thing and subscribe to the service and get a monthly influx of games, new and old, and some exclusives. People know it best as pretty much the only way to play Mega Man the Wily Wars in America, mm-hmm, right, for quite a while, because they were going to release it in retail, but decided not to. So it was a Sega Channel exclusive. And it's some of the features of Sega Channel sort of telegraph things that you can do now. You can get game demos, you know, time demos, and you have news updates, all the stuff that we all so take for granted now. But those two early network initiatives from Sega were kind of neat in that way. And of course, Sega would push on later on Saturn and Dreamcast.
Was there any other way to play Wily Wars, or was that it? I don't remember it ever being released on any other platform.
Oh, no. I mean, it got a European retail release.
In
Japan, too.
Right. I mean, I think like the doom of Sega, or like Sega's, I don't know, it feels like they were always ahead of their time, and that's what killed them. It's like, this was Netflix, you know, and I feel like this is the way game distribution is going to work soon, if no major shakeouts happen. But I mean, PlayStation Plus is sort of like what the Sega Channel is now, where it's, mm-hmm. like, here are the free games this month.
Yeah, exactly. Sega also branched out into different sorts of... I mean, they took on anything they could, basically, or wanted to. Like, there was a weird initiative, I think, by Blockbuster Video to, like, distribute media. You know, you'd go up to the kiosk and then, you know, rewrite the media and get movies or music, and then games, only Sega Genesis games at the time, but yeah, you could get this rewritable cartridge and then take it home.
Wow.
That was I forget the name of it now. I think it's involved the name Leaf or something like that. But yeah, Sega would do almost anything to that. As far as accessories, though, I'll go a little bit simpler and just talk quickly about like the different controllers, such as the Arcade Power Stick, very early release, I think, close to the launch of the Genesis. And much like the Sega Master System joystick, just a big thing, big buttons. They did release a 6-button variant later, maybe not in America. I did not completely check up on that. But after that was the 6-button pad, and that was released in America in time for Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter 2, and you needed it to play those properly.
Did it launch with the... I know the first Street Fighter 2 on Genesis was Championship Edition, right?
Special Championship Edition.
And that was it, that the controller came out like sort of, you know, alongside of it?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much same time as that in Mortal Kombat, because, you know, they were 5 and 6 button games. Genesis was only 3, and unless you wanted to, you know, try
hold down the start button,
right,
the
fiddle with that
modifier, yeah.
You had to buy. Same situation that PC Engine owners would face with Street Fighter as well.
Oh god.
But you know, it's funny because it's possible to play a good Street Fighter style game with only 2 buttons, and SNK really got that right with their Neo Geo Pocket Color games, where they figured out, you know, the strength of an attack depends on how long you hold down the button.
Yes,
it's weird that no one stumbled onto that, which seems like a pretty obvious mechanic in hindsight.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe they just thought, no, it wouldn't be practical or something. But yeah, you're right. You think that would have been decided,
or maybe that would have changed the timing of the game. So I guess it makes some kind of sense, but
it's also like if they built the controller that way, maybe they didn't think about that ahead of time. It would, I don't know the programming side of it, but it might have been more difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Genesis 6 button pad also had the mode button, which I guess for some games that would completely blank out at the prospect of 6 buttons. You had to like hold it down or something when you started a game, so it would revert to a 3 button mode.
I mean, like the move to 6 button controller was necessary if they wanted to keep competition alongside the SNES, but it felt like it created this weird have and have not classes as far as Genesis owners went. And so they could never take advantage of the 6 button controller too much because there's always going to be people who didn't have it.
That does happen though. I mean, sometimes moving forward in the middle of a generation of hardware requires that kind of have and have not, and Sony had to do that with the dual.
That's right. I was trying to think of another. That's right. But I feel like more games took advantage of that, and they were willing to cut more people loose. Like, no, no, Ape Escape, you need this.
Right. There weren't a lot of Sony PS1 games designed specifically for the DualShock, but a lot of games took advantage of it. They did a good job of balancing that out. But I guess. No, I don't know. I was going to say like 3 to 6 buttons is a more fundamental change, but I don't think so. I think the second analog controller, and well, just analog control in general, makes a big difference.
Well, anyway, I'm sure Sega sold many of those 6 button pads, and of course other companies released 6 button controllers once that started to become the agreed upon standard. Capcom released their Street Fighter arcade stick for the Genesis as well. This great big thing, you know.
I had one of those.
Yeah.
Hated it.
I had the Super Nintendo version. I liked it.
I really wanted to like it, but like in retrospect, like the buttons, like you press one side and it gets like stuck all the time. And maybe it's just mine. Maybe I spilled soda in or something.
Maybe.
It seemed like at the time it was great to have any stick. But then looking back, it's like...
That one was backwards compatible with the NES, and I lost the connector cable to the Super Nintendo one, so I had a very elaborate NES joystick for a while. Back to the Genesis. You know, we had very practical things like a 6-button pad, but there was also like a brief period where Sega just sort of was playing catch-up with Nintendo. And when Nintendo made the Super Scope for the Super NES, Sega countered with the Menacer for the Genesis, which again was a very unrealistic looking gun, gun for the Genesis.
Although it still had gray at that time, right? It was before they were forced to do like orange guns.
I remember it being a grayer shade of
gray. It had the orange nose.
Okay.
Or red nose.
Yeah, I mean, they had to make the Zapper orange for the NES. So
okay.
So that was, you know, that predated the Menacer.
Mm. Yeah.
It wasn't like, I remember it was Saturn, I guess it was, that the entire gun became.
Yeah,
like bright,
and then the GunCon
and Dreamcast, GunCon. Where the gun became totally transparent.
It's like I couldn't even see it.
Yeah.
It's like a miracle.
Yeah. So, you know, the Super Scope was not that well supported. There were a few games made for it, and not all terrible. But you know, the Menacer got pretty much nothing.
Oh,
I would say so.
There's one big example you're.
I'm
getting to.
Go ahead, Matt. Go ahead. You haven't talked enough. Go ahead.
Terminator 2.
Right.
The big, the main arcade game, light gun game of the time.
You are right. You are right. In fact, let's play the commercial for that right now.
When I play Terminator 2 with the Sega Menacer, I'm not afraid of deadly hunter killers, the indestructible T-1000, endless endoskeletons, the evil Skynet. Nothing. Bobby! Give your Aunt Bertha a big kiss. Well, almost nothing.
Okay,
Whoa.
let's not guess what's going on in the last seconds there.
That was totally in my face.
Yeah. But the Minister did also come with a pack-in game, much like the Super Scope, which included a very rare appearance from Toe Jam and Earl.
I was going to mention, yeah, it was weird that's one of their three Sega Genesis appearances.
Ready, Aim, Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Which sounds great. Sounds like a great concept, but it is basically just running around shooting tomatoes at enemies that come in on the screen, and, well, Toe Jam and Earl cheer you on.
Hmm.
Hey, whatever works.
So kind of like a precursor to Point Blank?
A little bit. Still not as fun. There were other games, I believe, in that pack that I have no idea what they were. It's really, Toe Jam and Earl kind of stand out on that. But yeah, Terminator 2, maybe Revolution X. I have no idea.
Wasn't it later than that? I can't remember.
It was later, but
like,
they couldn't support it.
Lethal Enforcers, you couldn't use the Menacer with, could you? I know that had its own gun and everything.
Lethal Enforcers, yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of light guns, Lethal Enforcers came with the Justifier, blue gun, much like the arcade cabinet, bright blue. You could send away for the pink one, the Player 2 gun, which I believe was daisy chained onto the Player 1 gun with like a telephone type cord. That was that. Yeah, that was sort of the brief light gun history of the Genesis.
Justifier is such a weird name for a gun. I've got a gun. What's my opinion is right.
Yeah.
Or else it's just it aligns everything along a column.
I think it's more the first one.
Nothing says I have a power trip than the Justifier.
Like the Justifier.
Yeah,
it's like Death Wish guy named it or something.
Exactly. So again, like I said, Sega met the Super Scope with the Menacer. They also met the Super NES mouse with the Mega Mouse.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I've never heard of that.
What the hell did you play with that thing?
You played Art Alive.
Okay.
I believe you played Wacky Worlds with it. And
was there a port of Lemmings to Sega Genesis?
There was, but I'm pretty sure they did not support it. I think it was before that. Yeah, it was basically just like, oh, they made a mouse with this art game. We better make a couple of those, too. Pretty sure that was just the story with that.
Okay, I take back what I said about Sega not seeing Nintendo as a rival as much as Namco.
Yeah.
Clearly that's not correct.
Uh-huh. Well, at least Sega of America, right? These are American things.
Yeah, I don't believe it came out in Japan.
Yeah.
It came out in Europe.
It's called Mega Mouse. It had to have come out somewhere outside of the US.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Not much to say about that. However, next up is pretty much the Genesis's power glove in the fact that it became sort of infamous over time. I'm sure you already know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is the Sega Activator.
I've always wanted to stand in the middle of a U-Force.
Uh-huh.
And all my dreams can come true.
It's like a power pad and a U-Force and a power glove all at once.
It's like, what are the worst ideas and how do we combine them?
It's like an Omni, right? Isn't that what it's called these days?
I don't know.
The Oculus thing?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh. It lives on through this hand.
I see. Yes, the Activator is a hexagonal ring, and each of the sides of that hexagon basically have an infrared beam shooter that, lays up, you lay it on the floor, it shoots up to the ceiling, basically. And you move your arm or your hand into the path of that beam, and that registers as a button input.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little bit from the instructional video that comes with the Activator, which I believe was like over $100, by the way.
Remember, the Activator is for indoor use only. Any room with a standard ceiling height will do. Just be sure to give yourself enough space to move around. You don't want to be crowded when you use the Activator. Avoid setting up directly beneath light sources. Also, avoid metallic or mirrored overhead surfaces.
Make sure all your pets are out of the room. This thing will blind them.
I like that they use Super NES slap bass for that.
Yeah.
By the way, it also came with a set of stickers for button labels that you could... button labels.
Roller. Panel 2 is the B button. Panel 8 is the C button. Panels 1, 3, 5, and 7 act as the directional pad. When hit individually, panels 4 and 6 are like the A button. When hit together, they're the start move.
What? You know what this reminds me of, Ray? It reminds me of the instructional video Homer's watching to fix his drywall.
Yes. That's your Activator primer. And by the way, does this sound familiar to anybody?
You are the controller.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Why do we never learn?
Why do we?
Jeremy's just quit video games. I want to say, like,
out, guys.
This feels like this came out in the wake of the controversy we talked about in previous Retronauts, you know, video game violence stuff. I feel like this was kind of like a Trojan horse. The Trojan horse was like, now your kids will be active playing these dumb, stupid things. You know?
This is not on my soundboard, but I did find a YouTube clip of an ABC morning show which covered the activator. So very much this show, ABC Home, was pretty much a parody of like all those morning shows. A very happy man and woman, very bright, trying to play the activator with the Evander Holyfield boxing game. And then the people on the sidelines on the show are like, yeah, this is great for the kids. Yeah, getting them active and all that. Yeah, maybe I can even beat up my husband in the game. and in addition to that, also you can find on YouTube Siskel and Ebert playing the activator
as part of
their holiday gift guide special.
Did they give a thumbs down?
I don't know.
Or the thumbs
did they
even
punch each other?
It was for a goof. No, they did not punch each other directly, but they did play the same boxing game. So I can imagine that was Sega's press blitz.
Like, we found one game that will work.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
was there any game made for it? I seem to remember it being advertised with like Eternal Champions.
Streets of Rage, I always saw them playing.
Yeah,
it,
but none of these like make sense for it because you have to use D-pad.
Anything had punches or kicks in it, Sega was like, we got to put in something with that.
Sadly, Activision never made anything for it.
Mm. I believe that tape did say that some games would be specially designed for the activator, but it's basically just regular button inputs, so I don't think that really happened.
When I got a DDR pad, I played through Klonoa with it. Well, not through it, but a few levels. I'm like, I don't need to buy an activator now. I'm just reliving the experience.
Right. Yes.
I mean, it is basically the same problems Kinect has had, which is it's you know, it lags behind what you do. So you'll think of something, by the time you're done with it, it's only like halfway done.
Exactly. Why do we never learn, like Bob said? And I think that was pretty much the extreme peak of Sega's sort of hubris about throwing all these accessories and add-ons at the Genesis and all that.
Well, Sega VR.
Sega VR, which, I mean, yes, that never really came out, but Sega was also talking a lot about this VR headset that would come out for the Genesis, but didn't seem to really get anywhere. Probably did not get out of any sort of prototype stage.
There's a prototype floating around.
Okay,
but it's
but software wise, I mean, who knows?
They announced a few games. I think I get it confused with the Jaguar one,
right?
But I think there were a couple games that were like prototyped, but. Not that it matters. I think
Jaguar VR came a little bit closer to coming out.
Maybe.
Relatively.
Yeah.
They demonstrated it. I don't think there was ever a demonstration of Sega VR. Mm. But that was also like, this and the Activator is pretty much introduced pretty much too late in the Genesis library. I mean, life. This was like 95 going into 96.
Donkey Kong Country, Cataclysm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we had to contend with the launch of the 32X, and then the Saturn. And all that, while also supporting Sega CD, a little bit of Game Gear. It was probably a bit of a circus. Kind of amazing that the Activator even came out. So, like, from Sega, those are the accessories I wanted to talk about. But really quickly, there were some 16-bit multi-platform accessories that, you know, came out for both that and the Super NES. I'm thinking of the Victor Max Stuntmaster. Speaking of VR, this was basically like a crappy LCD headset.
I would see that in magazines and I was like, how did that work? You know,
I've never heard of that.
It was nothing but just a cheap headset.
Yeah.
To make you pretend you're in VR world.
Yeah.
Except it's just like a projection screen. There was also the Aura Interactor. Matt, you seem to really want to talk about this.
Well, I stumbled into one at a store like a couple months ago and I never actually owned it, but it always seemed like the weirdest possible thing. Like it's basically speakers in a vest and they turn up like the bass so you feel the vibration.
Yeah, the Interactor, okay.
This was advertised quite a bit at the time and it's basically like you strap a big block of plastic to yourself and that is like a big, great big subwoofer.
The sound system.
There might have been like a chair, not from the same company, but like a chair that
I know what you're talking
thing.
About. It's like a chair that sort of like pivots or something.
Yeah,
there was a chair. I believe maybe it was official or not. Or
and the speakers
like
sort of came out like next to your ears. They like folded out from the chair.
But I can't think of any kind of weird chair like that without thinking of the one George Clooney makes in Burn After Reading.
I didn't see that.
The sex chair.
Okay. I get it. So the Interactor was just, a very expensive subwoofer that you could strap to a child's chest and make them
feel like
I wonder
if there are any health problems associated with that.
Probably.
It'll break up your kidney stones, I guess.
Yeah.
A generation grew up hollow-chested because of the Interactor.
So the Interactor really went nowhere. Yeah, there's probably a lot you can find still in a thrift store somewhere.
Wow.
Lastly, I want to talk about one last modem. Of course, the X-Band.
Thank you.
This kind of does not have origins in a partnership with AT&T and Sega, where they wanted to produce the Edge 16 modem / service for internet gaming for the Genesis. This came out, you know, a little bit before the X-Band did, in like, again, mid-90s, 94, just into 95. That deal fell through, but in its wake came the X-Band, and that was, you know, that was released, and that had a bit more of a cohesive vision behind it. Again, it was a plug-in cartridge. You plug it in there and then put your game on top of that, and then you can subscribe and sign up for the X-Band service, which was, you know, a pretty rudimentary online service for the time, but for a game console, you did get quite a bit of interesting, kind of innovative stuff for the time. You had simple email, you had news updates, you could challenge people, you could have a friends list, there were tournaments for all sorts of supported games, sports games, Street Fighter II, Super Mario Kart as well, and it also had like a special syncing technology. I don't know how great it was. But this was basically just a phone-based modem. You can call up anybody you wanted within reason and play a real game with them over the phone lines. And, yeah, like I said, the service itself telegraphed a lot of things that, again, we take for granted.
Yeah, but just thinking about how they got to work is kind of mystifying. It feels like it's the internet equivalent of smoke signals yeah. today, you know.
Or the equivalent of, like, OnLive. Like, how'd they figure that out? How do they sell that? But, you know, anyone who got an X-Band, I'm not one of them, but, you know, if you subscribed and signed up, you really started to join a community, and a lot of people do have X-Band nostalgia, and there are...
I've heard it, yeah.
There are people on YouTube who archive X-Band footage, and you can still experience it, especially...
So they were, like, VHS recording their games? Wow, cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, like, what console gamers had instead of BBSs.
Yeah, basically. And it was all flashier, and, you know, they had hardcore art style.
Hippies had well, we had X-Band.
Yes, indeed. And it's interesting to me that the Genesis did get a lot of modems, things that came out and did not come out. There was also, forget what the heck it was called now, drawing a blank, but it was another sort of intended modem thing where you could, from a sort of a fly-by-night company, that they were going to make a modem that you could play crappy games on Genesis, but also against NES players if you wanted. So there was some sort of intention there to make a multi-platform network. That did not work. But yeah, that and the Mega Modem and X-Band and the ill-fated Edge 16 and all that stuff. That's really, really the big ones that I wanted to touch on with Genesis accessories, because... You know, there were some goofy ones last time when we talked about NES. There were some goofy ones that had some interesting features to them, but didn't really go anywhere. The Genesis, it was mostly a lot of different controllers, you know, sticks and whatnot. And then these really crazy out there things like the Activator and weird attempts to try and steal some Nintendo's thunder, like the Menacer. So that's Retronauts Pocket for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Matt, again, for joining us.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Bob and Jeremy for being the usual guys.
You betcha.
Who try and humor me.
I can't stop being me, Ray.
Okay. Well, that's good.
I can't quit you, Ray.
Once again, we are everywhere on the internet. Retronauts.com, Retronauts on Twitter, on Facebook, SoundCloud, YouTube. Please come and find us. You can find all the information about the show, at least, on Retronauts.com. Please give us good reviews on iTunes. Maybe I did not mention that on the last main episode. I apologize, but please be nice to us on iTunes. Give us good reviews. We appreciate it. We want to be up there in the charts. But again, thanks everybody for indulging me nonetheless, and I'll see you next time. Bye.
Continuing our holiday video gift guide, each year Roger and I conclude the show by playing a video game. This year, Sega's greatest heavyweights, not using one of those old-fashioned hand controllers, but the new Activator body ring so with infrared light, so my kicks translate to punches to the body, punches are punches to the head.
And Gene, if you put your hand back like this, it's a verbal insult.
We do that without infrared on our own show.
Round one.